Okay, we're studying the miracle of Jesus feeding the 5,000, which is found, anyone know where? That's right, all four. If you'd have said Matthew or Mark, Luke or John, you'd have been right. And from what I understand, it's the only miracle that has been shared in that way. So obviously there's something very important about it and significant that each one of the writers felt the need to mention it and to share it with their audience. We're going to look at Mark's account, since we had studied his account with John the Baptist's beheading. It just kind of naturally picks up from there in Mark chapter 6, verse 30. Mark chapter 6, verse 30. Now remember, the disciples had been sent out, the 12 had been sent out, and now have returned. And so that's where we pick up in Mark 6:30. Then the apostles gathered to Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. And he said to them, "Come aside by yourselves to a deserted place and rest a while." For there were many coming and going, and they did not even have time to eat. So they departed to a deserted place in the boat by themselves. All right, so here we see them come back and no doubt excited to share with the Lord the people that they have met, the studies that they had, discussions, the various sermons that had been presented, and to come together and share notes with one another about these great things. It was kind of the first time that he kind of cut the apron strings and sent them on their own. It was very specific instructions as to what they were to do and how they were to do what they were to do. So they come back and the Lord says, first and foremost, we need you to rest. We need you to rest. For those that have preached a lesson, delivered a sermon, you know the anxiety, the nervousness, the adrenaline, all of that that courses through the veins, so that after the presentation is finished, you feel a great sense of relief and fatigue at the same time. And especially if you are like them, going to places where you are not familiar, and most likely delivering more than one lesson in the day. Multiple lessons. They would be extremely famished and tired. And the Lord's recipe to all that was to rest. To rest. I was thinking of what Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 12:12, where he said, "To the making of many books there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh." That is true. That is very, very true. There are some that are of the opinion that the preacher doesn't work because he doesn't get out and swing a hammer. However, the Bible makes it very clear that much study is wearisome to the actual physical body itself, the flesh, when the mind is being activated in such a way. And then utilized in presenting God's Word, it is extremely exhausting. And so, especially when it comes Sunday night, I know exactly what they're saying right here, where you just want to get away a little bit, rest, and recover. And so they departed to a deserted place in the boat by themselves. And so God has desired through Jesus Christ to show them the appropriate means to do what after they have been on such an excursion, to go ahead and break away from the people. Now, I think we all know what it's like after a good hard day, and especially after hard weeks of work, to just need some moments, you know, if not hours, just to yourself, to recollect and to regroup mentally and physically. And so we have to respect each other when it comes to such instances as that. And I say that because I can recall a time where I had plans set up for that particular night, some things that I had desired to do, and I remember this person is not here anymore, but they had called me and desired that I come within the hour to eat dinner with them and their family. And I told them, I'm sorry to disappoint you, and, you know, I've already got the evening scheduled. Well, I got undressed from all of that, and it's sometimes individuals feel that at a drop of a hat the evangelist needs to be ready and to go and to see the affairs of every individual. Now, I understand the need to be flexible, and I understand the need to be available. But to change plans at the very last minute is something that I wouldn't even ask somebody else to do themselves. And so we see here that the Lord even understood that it was wise, appropriate to break away from others so that they might be able to regroup. There's certainly scriptural grounds for that. Now, in chapter 1 of Mark, verse 35, Mark 1, verse 35, there we see they learned this from the master teacher himself, where Jesus had, in verse 32, 33, and 34, been about healing and helping others. Then verse 35, in the morning, having risen a long while before daylight, he went out and departed to a solitary place, and there he prayed. And so here we see Jesus breaking free at a place to be alone where he might be with him and God. And we see verse 36, Simon and those who were with him searched for him, and when they found him, they said to him, everyone is looking for you. And so everybody has been trying to search for the Lord when he needed a moment to himself. And the Lord says, let us go to the next towns that I may preach there also. And so he understood the need for balance and also the need when to get back to the work as well. And so here we see he does with the disciples what he himself has done before. Comments or questions about any of this here, just at the get-go? Yes. Right. Yes. Very, very good comment. Anybody else? All right. So we see they break away for a little bit, but it's not for too awful long. Because verse 33, it says, the multitude saw them departing, and many knew him, and ran there on foot from all the cities. They arrived before them and came together to him. So it's very much like we read there in Mark 1, where, hey, everyone's looking for you. Where you been? Well, they see him get in the boat. They're here, there he is with the 12, and they're going this way. And many of them know him and know his connections to Capernaum and Galilee, and we know where he's going. And so on foot, they really huff it to be able to beat him to the place. And so when they arrive, there is this great multitude. Back to the work. Verse 34, and Jesus, when he came out, saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion for them, because they were like sheep not having a shepherd. So he began to teach them many things. So Jesus was glad to hear from the disciples what they had learned, what they had experienced. And now Jesus is back to the work, and the disciples are able to watch and to see what he is doing. He sees this great multitude, sheep like without a shepherd, and so he begins to feed the flock. And the food is what?
Spiritual food.
That's right. It's the teaching. So he began to teach them. I was thinking of John chapter 10. John 10, verse 4, and really the whole chapter 10 would apply very nicely. But Jesus said in John 10:4, "And when he brings out his own sheep, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice." And so here's the sheep that have come. They know who he is, and they are glad. They're glad to hear his teaching, to receive that spiritual sustenance. They hear his voice. You might think about pastors, elders, bishops. It's all the same office, right? Scripturally speaking, a pastor is a bishop. A bishop is an elder, and an elder is a pastor and bishop, on and on and so forth. Overseer, same term. And over, what are they told to do?
Pastor the flock.
That's right. Shepherd the flock of God which is among you. 1 Peter 5:2. To feed the flock, to pastor is the word to shepherd. And so these individuals are expected by God to meet certain qualifications, right? So that they have that know-how to lead a flock in the way of God. Because they have to make sure it's not being led in their way. They want them to hear his voice, Jesus' voice. And so they have to be apt or able to teach. For 1 Timothy chapter 3 says they have that ability. Titus chapter 2 is another good reference. Titus chapter 2, in regards to those bishops, the elders. Titus 2, there it says in verse... Sorry, not Titus 2, Titus 1. Titus 1, verse 9. You'll notice there, here in regards to the elders in verse 5. And by the way, notice he calls them elders in verse 5, and then bishops in verse 7. So we see he's talking about the same category of leadership. And then in verse 9, he says that they need to be holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and convict those who contradict. And so the great need to be skilled in the Word of God so that they might accurately lead the sheep of God, just as Jesus was doing his best here in the feeding of the 5,000 before that takes place. Comments about any of that? All right, rolling right along then. In Mark 6, continuing, it says, verse 35, "When the day was now far spent, his disciples came to him and said, 'This is a deserted place, and already the hour is late. Send them away that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat.'" So evidently this crowd had stayed pretty much the whole day. It was like a full day gospel meeting, beginning to a day to the end of the day, and they're hearing the words of Christ without a lunch break. I mean, no one's breaking, you know, between morning and afternoon service, evening service, right? They just keep on going, keep on rolling. And where they're at is a deserted place, and it probably was the best place for this kind of audience or crowd of thousands and thousands and thousands of people, where they say it would be like a natural amphitheater and can be able to hear the message of Christ. But the problem was they didn't have any McDonald's nearby. So they're going to have to depart, going to kind of, you know, get everybody to go their way so they can be able to go and eat. But the Lord turns us into a teaching opportunity with his disciples. He says, verse 37, "He answered and said to them, 'You give them something to eat.'" Now, could you imagine how surprising that would be to hear that? I mean, there is a flood of people, perhaps the very population size of Franklin. There's 5,000 men, so who knows? Women and children, 12,000, perhaps. And Jesus says, "You give them something to eat." Well, you know, that's not possible. Maybe he's joking. The first thing I would do is probably laugh a little bit, you know, knowing that this is a joke that we're just sharing. He said to them, "Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give them something to eat?" And so, I mean, just the idea, just if they were to even have a smidge, it cost them 200 denarii. That was just a rough estimate. Denarii being a day's worth of wages. So 200 days, two-thirds of a year. Was that 30,000, you know, whatever it might be, 30, 40,000, who knows? I mean, a lot of money. And it would just give a smidge of food for each and every individual. So Jesus says, verse 38, he said to them, "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." And when they found out, they said, "Five and two fish." So he says, all right, kind of see if anyone's willing to volunteer their sack lunch. And so someone's got five loaves and two fish. So I believe it's a little boy that has this. And so evidently Jesus is trying to teach them that sustenance, blessing, provision all come from one source. And that is from him. What they are unable to do, what Philip was unable to provide, he would take care of. So he tells them, here's what we're going to do. Verse 39, commanded them to make them all sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in ranks, in hundreds and in fifties. And when he had taken the five loaves and the two fish, he looked up to heaven, blessed, and broke the loaves, and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And the two fish he divided among them all. So, again, this is hard to conceptualize in our even in our mind's eye. But we know this part. He takes what he's given and prays to God about it, right? He offers a prayer of thanks for it. Which, if you think about it, is a good example of praying before you eat, right? Even at a public meal, this is very public. And here he is blessing this bread and two fish. And then begins to divide it. And gives it to the disciples. And the disciples then begin to distribute. It'd be an awful lot of dividing, wouldn't it? And dividing a fish. I don't know have you ever divided a fish? Yeah, I haven't either. But I get the idea that that'd be kind of a... Okay, so maybe it was cooked and...
He didn't feed them all. The mother that prepared the meal would not have sent them.
That's a good point. That's a good point. That's right. A mother would not have given that to a boy. You're right. So evidently it's divided, cooked all along the way. And there they have enough for everybody. And more than enough, right? More than that 200 denarii could have done. Because we see there, verse 42, so they all ate and were filled full of fragments. They were filled. And they took up 12 baskets full of fragments and of the fish. So it's a mighty miracle. You end up with more than you started off with. I mean, it defies all the laws of physics, which says that, you know, mass can change shape or form, but it cannot, be dissolved or be made more than what it was before. And here, that's exactly what takes place. You end up with more. What's that? That's right. It's creation. It's creation that's taking place here. And again, it must have been speedy creation, too, if you think about how many people are there and are needing to be fed. Let me show you an example. Do you have a comment, Nancy?
I was just going to comment. I'll read Luke, John 6, verse 12. Verse 12, Jesus said, "Blessed are the leftovers." It says, "So when they were filled, he said to his disciples, 'Gather up the fragments that remain, so that nothing is lost.'" And that teaches us not to be
wasteful. Yeah, that's right.
It says, "So that nothing is lost."
And to utilize the blessings that have been given to us. Right. And unfortunately, I've been too guilty of having thrown out leftovers or spoiled food that I didn't get to use in time. But we should be good stewards with what we've been blessed with.
That's when we think about it. Think about how much food we have. Mm. You know, of course, we do realize this was, you know, different, but the principle is there.
Right, right. Good comments, good comments. Yes, Angela. And if we were to draw that analogy even further, how many times have we read a passage and understood it, but then later on read a passage and understand more of it, or understand more of its connections or applications? It begins to multiply. And so the spiritual food itself has a very interesting parallel to the very physical bread that the Lord multiplied. That's a good comment, Sister Ross.
Can you imagine the story the little boy had? What his day was like?
Yeah, the parents might have thought he was telling a whopper. What's that?
Got grounded for life.
Yeah, exactly. You didn't like the meal, you just threw it away, you just made up a big story.
Could you imagine giving your child, you know, bread and fish to go to school with?
Yeah, the lunches have changed quite a bit today. Look at 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 16. Here, on a small scale, you see glimpses of God showing and shadowing this ability being used here through the prophet Elijah, where he meets a woman, and she does not have much left to eat, her and her son, because there's a great famine on the land. And there's just a little bit left for one more meal. And Elijah comes with a message from God, and he says, cook me a meal first. And if you do that, you'll be taken care of. So it required a step of faith. And when she did that, at his command, you'll notice in verse 15, it says, so she went away and did according to the word of Elijah, and she and he and her household ate for many days. The bin of flour was not used up, nor did the jar of oil run dry, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Elijah. So every day she'd go into that pot and be able to pull up some flour and some oil, and the next day she'd look at it and be at the exact same level. It was a miracle of creation, of multiplication, continuous. And that was just for one family. So here Jesus does it for 10,000 plus, I'm assuming. And this is on a very, very grand scale. Now, you remember what he taught on the Sermon on the Mount about worry? What did he say about worrying? You should worry. You should worry about what you shall eat, what you shall drink. You should worry about what you put on. No. What did he say?
You should not.
You should not worry.
Let the day take care of itself.
Yeah, you should not worry. So where we get our food and all these things, he's saying, don't worry about it. And we see that, how do you put it, that His actions meet his words, right? He has all kinds of ability to provide and to take care of. You know, it might be one thing for me to say, don't worry, you know, but, you know, in the end, I can't, you know, I'm not powerful like that. But he, when he says, don't worry, and then shows something like this, well, it makes sense. If he can do this miraculously, then it's so easy for him to do it providentially then, right? Right. Right. To cut the anchor loose in having faith in the world and keep it strong in God. Understanding He's the one that framed the world, created the world, is the author of creation. Here we see it illustrated in the feeding of 5,000. Such an important miracle, so important it's recorded by all of the writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And so we don't want to miss out on the significance of this. And I think there's something else that we can grasp from this as well. Jesus does this with the bread and the fish, right? And He feeds all these people. Now, if you remember in the book of Exodus, I believe Exodus chapter 18. No, it'd be 16. Exodus chapter 16, where the Israelites were worried about food. And in Exodus 16, verse 15, God had miraculously provided bread from heaven. And so when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, "This is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat." And He fed a whole company, a whole multitude, with this bread, and continued to sustain them throughout their wilderness years. And so there would be no doubt a very real comparison to what was done in the days of Moses to now what is being done through Jesus Christ. And illustrating what Moses said, that there will be a prophet likened unto me that shall come, and he is greater than I. So here we see Jesus fit that picture so well. And it wouldn't be the only time He does this, right? There'll be another occasion where He feeds the 4,000 with bread once again. And so God giving all these pointers, these prophetic pointers to what took place in the Old Testament, and showing how Jesus was the reality of all these things.
You can think about, you know, He says He is the bread of life.
Yeah.
Think about that with He feeds bread. The Lord sent bread to the Israelites.
And where was He born? Jesus, where was He born?
In Nazareth.
Bethlehem. Bethlehem, right? Which means a house of bread. A house of bread. So all this connected to the bread of heaven. Uh-huh. That's right. 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 To completely trust in His provision. That's right. All right. So let's look at John chapter 6, which is the parallel account to this. It adds a couple more details. John chapter 6, and what you'll see is that they grasped, there were some there that grasped the connection. In John 6, verse 13, it says, "Therefore they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves which were left over by those who had eaten. Then those men, when they had seen the sign that Jesus did, said, 'This is truly the prophet who has come into the world.'" See, they saw it, and they got it. There were some that got it and said, "This is Him. This is the prophet." And so, verse 15 says, "Therefore, when Jesus perceived they were about to come and take Him by force to make Him king, He departed again to the mountain by Himself alone." So some were so excited about this. They said, "We got to make Him king." Now, there were some, no doubt, that did that because of the religious connections. That this is the prophet, the Messiah. And there's probably some that were doing that because hey, you know, we all like a president that gives the handout, right? And I mean, if this kind of handout is indicative of his rule and reign and presidency, then sure, we'd love him to be king. So whatever the motive might have been, they were ready to do it by force and to put him in that place. But did Jesus come to have an earthly kingdom? No. A spiritual one.
They were not impressed by the healing miracles that he did. Neither were the apostles. Yeah. It was the storm that impressed the apostles, and it was feeding their bellies that impressed the people.
The crowd. Yeah, you're right. None of them ever, it never says that they came to make him by king by force after healing the multitudes. It's a good point. So, again, the connection to, you know, this could be advantageous to us to have this kind of political leader. Jesus did not come for that purpose. But that was a difficult pill to swallow for many of them, for most of them, even the disciples, because a lot of them saw that there was a time where he's going to be this king in this kingdom. And even remember some of the disciples' mother would ask, you know, can you he sit in your right hand and the other one sit at your left hand? And even after Jesus' resurrection, Acts chapter 1, you know, they even said, now is the time that the kingdom returns back to Israel. And that, you know, so there's all this misunderstanding about the very kingdom that Jesus was coming to bring. It would be the church. It would be the spiritual kingdom where the spiritual goal is saving souls so that we might make it to that physical kingdom in heaven one day. So Jesus walks away from this. Now, if you ever meet individuals that are premillennial in their background and their understanding, a lot of Baptists fit this picture where they believe, you know, there's a sign of the times, Jesus is coming back and he's going to set up a kingdom in Jerusalem and sit on the throne of David and the temple's going to be rebuilt. Point out this verse right here. Say, Jesus had a chance. He had a chance for that. But he didn't come for that. That was never his purpose then or even in the future. Now, what takes place next is very interesting. We see verse 16 of John 6. When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and went over towards the Sea of Capernaum. And it was already dark, and Jesus had not come to them. Flip back to Mark's account, Mark chapter 6, where there we get more of a picture. Mark 6, 45. Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he sent the multitude away. And when he had departed, and when he had sent them away, he departed to the mountain to pray. So Jesus, again, kind of separates himself from the crowd, but even also from the disciples, and tells them, get in the boat, you go over that away, and I'm going over here on this mountain to pray. Now, in this meantime, you can imagine the wind starting to grow and to howl, and the storm comes upon the sea. Now, this is the second time that a storm has come upon the sea. And the Bible says in verse 47, when evening came, the boat was in the middle of the sea, and he was alone on the land. Then he saw them straining at rowing, for the wind was against them. So Jesus is up there on the mountain. He looks down into the Sea of Galilee, and he can see them in the distance there, rowing against the wind as best they can, straining against the wind. And then in the middle of that verse 48, when the fourth watch of the night came, he came to them walking on the sea and would have passed them by. And when they saw him walking on the sea, they supposed it was a ghost and cried out. For they all saw him and were troubled. But immediately he talked with them and said to them, be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid. So the Lord begins to make his way, and I find it interesting that he doesn't have much difficulty at all, if any, walking across the boisterous waters with all this wind. It almost seems like cartoony, I guess is the best word to use. You've seen the cartoons where Bugs Bunny's paddling as fast as it can, and meanwhile the other guy's just moseying on by, no trouble. I mean, that's kind of the idea that I picture here. They're straining, and And Jesus is walking, and he was about to pass by, and they all see him, and they're terrified. And wouldn't you be too? I mean, this is the middle of the night. Perhaps only the moonlight is bouncing off the garments of Christ, and here's walking. I mean, it's a ghost. I've never seen something like that before. This is terrifying. But he wants to calm the fears. It's me. It's me. And I'm saying it in a calm voice, but most likely they are all screaming at the top of their lungs. And to be able to hear each other over the howling wind, it would be the only way possible. As I be of good cheer, do not be afraid. So there's a couple things that I learned from that. The Lord doesn't want us to be afraid even when it looks like we should be afraid. And also that when we're in those moments and pushing off and flailing as much as we can, it's kind of comforting to know that He's up on the mountain and He can see us doing that. I mean, I think of the disciples that have known that Jesus is just right over there watching us. I think any kind of worry would have dissipated. They didn't know that, but it was happening. And so it's comforting to us to know that He sees from heaven whatever struggle that we're going through and is aware of our failing and rowing and all the kinds of things that we do to try and stay afloat. And He says the same. As I be of good cheer, do not be afraid. Yeah, so to know that He's with us and does not leave us alone, as He tells His disciples, I'll be with you always. Comments about that? Verse 51 then. Then He went up into the boat to them. Now, you and I know there's something that takes place between verse 50 and 51. Anyone remember?
Peter.
That's right. So Mark, for some reason, doesn't record that. And there we just see the individual nature of each writer being utilized. So let's look over in Mark, Matthew 14. Matthew 14, get more of the picture here from Matthew. Matthew 14, where Jesus is in verse 27, but immediately Jesus spoke to them, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." Now, I read that and I have no earthly idea why Peter would say that. That would never enter my mind. It would never even begin to come into my mind. But Peter's, it did. Yeah, obviously none of the 11, but to Peter's mind, who always, you know, jumped first, asked questions later, who never counted the cost, he was just all in. And deal with the repercussions later. What's that?
I've always heard the word impetuous.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. If it's you, you know, and by the way, he said, if it's you, wouldn't you want to make absolutely 100% for sure it was him before you take one step out into the water? But that just shows his nature. A lot to love about it, for sure. The zeal is contagious, though we might say he still had a lot to learn from as well. So Jesus says, "Come, come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water. He actually got to walk on the water. No other man has experienced what Peter has experienced. I still remember a Mythbusters I saw, one of those shows that was on Discovery Channel, where they tried and tried and tried to do this very thing, using different types of shoes and different kinds of inflatables where they could just try to pretend like they'd walk on the water. And nothing would work. Nothing would work.
There's a Jesus lizard that can walk on water for a short distance.
Ah.
Because it's part of the advertisement in front of a nature show that's coming.
I see. Appropriately so named, right? Well, here we have Peter doing it. And seems to be doing well. I mean, when his faith was strong, it just goes to show you could do anything. You could do anything with Jesus' help. But when the faith gets weak, it's as if you could do nothing, right? Because next is verse 30, when he saw the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, O you of little faith, why did you doubt? So here the Lord saves him. It reminds us again that the Lord appreciates our step of faith, but in our moment of doubt, it doesn't let us drown, but rather is there as our great advocate when we cry out to Him. But He does desire for us to mature in faith. I read that and I think, wow, Peter had a lot of faith to actually try and ask a question and actually to attempt to do that. But the Lord said it was little faith when He took His eyes off of him, which was the reason why he asked that question to begin with, and put it on the circumstances, the difficulties, the trials, the wind, the waves, everything else. It really had no power at all. Jesus is the one that had the power. But how often do we do that? We turn our attention to the things, the mundane things of life that are really not all that big of a deal or that important. And as the old saying goes, we make a mountain out of a molehill. And I am guilty of it too. But this is a good reminder to keep your eyes on the Lord. Keep it fixed. Now, so we finish before we run out of time. Verse 32 says, when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And then John's account says they were immediately at the shore. And so it was like he teleported them and the boat just to the shore. They were at the journey's end. Again, another miracle to take place. Now, you may have some comments you want to add about this. Write them down, and we'll talk about that a little bit before our next class, and then we'll jump into the next section, which is on page 108 of our booklets. 108, the second part of John 6. All right, thank you all for the good class tonight.